Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest is Dr. Elena Blocher, professor of medicine at Brown University and senior research scientist in the Division of Cardiology at the Miriam Hospital. She was originally a board-certified physician cardiologist in Italy for 2 decades prior to coming to the United States and earning a PhD in clinical epidemiology at the University of Massachusetts. In 2017, she became an elected fellow of the American Heart Association, and her research focuses on mind-body interventions that might improve cardiovascular health. Welcome, Dr. Blocher. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You have a new research project that I'm excited about, and that's why I reached out to you. This has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Institute on Aging. This is an R01, and you are the principal investigator. So you created this idea. You call this the Mind Your Heart 2 study, and you focus in on older adults who have heart failure and elevated cognitive impairment. And I also read your Mind Your Heart 1, which is a feasibility pilot trial. You've already published this. This was earlier in the year in the Journal of Cardiovascular Nursing. That was a single condition pilot study, and you examined a phone-based mindfulness training program delivered for 8 weeks, and you recommended home practice for 20 minutes to those outpatients. And you did find some improvement for cognitive function and cognitive capacity in older adults with heart failure. So could you summarize the history of how you got here? That's the most interesting piece. You have this new trial, and I'm sure you have been thinking about this for a while. So what did you find, and where do you think you are right now?
So first of all, I'd like to share how this all came about, right? And also as a way of honoring my late father, passed 2 years ago during the pandemic, who suffered from heart failure. So the way this study came about is just when I was, you know, lived in the US and I was having, you know, almost daily conversations with him on Zoom or, you know, other, you know, remote devices, and seeing him struggle with several things, you know, several problems, of which the most challenging ones were basically coping with all these demands of his self-care. So struggling with the medications he had to take, you know, remembering to actually take them, you know, all of them at the right time, going through phases of, you know, I don't want to deal with this, to, you know, oh my God, I got to do this, otherwise I'm going to die because the prognosis is really bad for heart failure patients. And as well as all the behavioral, you know, aspects of self-care, which, you know, checking your weight daily, dietary restrictions, and most importantly, sort of being aware of the changes in his body, like gaining fluids, which is really important part of self-care, is monitoring symptoms so that you don't wait too long before you get medical attention, because that can really change. You can avoid an admission, basically, which in older patients, you know, can be disastrous for other reasons. So by then I was already a mindfulness practitioner, and that's how, just seeing him struggle like that, that's when I said, well, Dad, how about, what if I send you a couple of, you know, CDs with some recorded things? How about, you feel like, you know, you would like to try them out? And the idea is saying, well, there might be something in mindfulness training and practice that may help, you know, people like my dad. And obviously my dad, you know, didn't do much with those and preferred this jazz music to my mindfulness CDs and the like. But that's how this study came about. So the first Mind Your Heart is really, you know, based on seeing real time the struggles of a, you know, family member. And then, of course, my patients. But with the patients, you never see them struggle in their life. You know, you see them in clinic, you see them in the hospital, you don't see how hard it is to take care of yourself, you know, when you have a chronic condition like that. So that was the beginning of everything. So of the whole, you know, this whole line of research. And the aspect that struck me more at the time was the problem with attention and forgetfulness, which my dad had to the largest extent. And also the literature shows that for different reasons related also to lack of sleep or, you know, poor sleep quality, heart failure patients tend to have cognitive problems. Some are also due to poor perfusion, you know, low heart, you know, low output, low cardiac output, poor perfusion of the brain, but also some are just related to concurrent conditions such as lack of sleep or poor sleep quality. So, and so there is a cognitive aspect, a cognitive impairment aspect to heart failure that I thought mindfulness could tackle. And the reason, you know, why mindfulness? Because at the same time, you started seeing some literature mentioning some benefits of mindfulness practice on attention and memory and certain aspects of cognitive function. When we put together the first application for the pilot study, it was really early days. You know, I felt kind of a pioneer because people were looking at a number of things, but not specifically at cognition yet. And so that was the first, you know, the sort of the main mediator, to use a technical word, you know, the main intermediate outcome whereby mindfulness may improve cognitive function, and then down the way, you know, self-care. So that was what led to the first, you know, Mind Your Heart, in which we looked really at these effects, mostly on cognitive function. And then we looked also just to have a peek into what could be the physiological effects. We looked at functional status. We did a 6-minute walk test whereby people, you know, you measure the distance walked in 5 minutes, and it's a marker of cardiac function and also a marker that is then related to prognosis. And this, the two interesting findings of this study is that we did observe improvements in almost all aspects of executive function, including attention and memory. And also we observed an increase in this 6-minute walk test in functional status, which I had, I mean, obviously we didn't have a control group, so you can't really say much about either. Right, because you could say, well, you know, supercritical people may say for the cognitive piece, well, that's a learning effect. Like people practice, and so obviously the second time they go through the cognitive testing, which was done using the NIH toolbox, you know, they get better at it because they learn, right? So, and I'll respond to that criticism later, but it's definitely a problem. For the functional status, we were very thrilled because we looked into other studies of behavioral interventions, and they you don't see any improvements in functional status. So my idea is that which we are trying to disentangle now in the larger control study is that something happened by virtue of the mindfulness training that then translated into a functional improvement. We're trying to understand what changed, you know, and then that's sort of the implant of the second study. But those were the most striking effects. And I must say, we did also assess effects of mindfulness training on the usual suspects, you know, anxiety, depression, stress, you know, those that are sort of psychological effects, sort of more well-known and sort of established. But we didn't see much also because, to my not great surprise, because in reality the literature shows that it's only a small proportion of patients that with a chronic condition that have depression, anxiety, and high levels of stress. And our patients really scored pretty much normal on those. So you can't really see an improvement when you start so well. You know, they already were so well positioned in that. So we didn't see any change in those factors.
Well, thank you for the connection here. This history is very kind of you to share. And the lineage of where this study came from is really important. And then the thing that comes to mind for me is what would a standard of care look like just outside of mind body practices? Because you are an MD as well. And so managing a patient with heart failure as an outpatient, like what's the standard? So what might a person expect to receive from a medical care team?
Well, you get obviously, medical treatment. There's solid pharmacological treatment and very effective treatment for heart failure. In terms of support for all the factors that I have mentioned before, the best chance is given to those that do go to cardiac rehab. There is an indication to do attend, cardiac rehab for patients that have heart failure. And those that do really receive a lot of benefits. Number one, from a targeted exercise programs, or they learn to exercise at their own level, because heart failure patients have problems and restrictions that are different from other cardiovascular patients. And then they can benefit, there is self-care educations about type of meds and all kind of encouragement to attain optimal medication adherence, and how important it is, that pharmacological treatment is effective, but only if people take their meds, right? If they don't or they forget, obviously the benefit is much lower. And then some cardiac rehab programs also offer stress reduction components. So, but other than cardiac rehab, I'm not aware of many options available. When a patient goes to a clinic, cardiac clinic, there is other problems usually that take the precedence. And I believe that a lot of this is left to, family doctors or primary care doctors, to encourage and help. But I'm not aware of anything structured that's available.
So
It's
that's
hard.
important. So then you're filling this gap because if it's medication prescription and a program that could improve exercise, but that program is maybe not always available to everybody,
Right.
what can we do to support the type of behaviors that would help people with heart failure manage daily life routines? So taking
Right. Well,
medications, exercising on their own, stress reduction, attention training on their own. So you're covering some of those gaps.
right. There, it may be argued that, also receiving that, if we show, that this approach is effective, then how are you going to offer it, right? Because mindfulness training is not currently paid by Medicare, right? Or I know maybe. Private insurances do pay for certain conditions. Perhaps I'm not 100% sure about this. I know that in England, in the UK, it is the National Health Service does offer mindfulness for specific conditions, and namely, I believe, relapse of depression, to prevent relapse of depression, because there's been a very strong trial showing, that mindfulness is as effective as medical treatment. But in our system, also access to mindfulness is a problem. I mean, we may say, well, if it's effective, then how are we going to offer it? So one step in that direction is that we offer the training, which I haven't said yet. All this is phone delivered, right? So we don't have a offer class-based training. So if we do show that the approach is effective, it could be offered, perhaps by nurse practitioners, right? But the point it eventually gets to there, can we get mindfulness offered, and paid for by Medicare or insurances? Because otherwise the patients will phone, or in presence or remotely, will have to bear the price, unless we go down the sort of app approach. But that has also some problems, which we can discuss later in this conversation. But anyway, the phone approach, again, was based mostly on the experience with my father that had, you know, I saw him struggle with technology. You know, he was at the time in his late 70s. And, you know, Zoom or, you know, Skype, it was always a challenge for him to connect, disconnect, whereas the phone was perfect. You know, he never had a problem. So because heart failure patients are older, we discussed, you know, the different options that we had. And we decided to go with the phone for that reason, because it is still the low, you know, low tech, widely available approach. The human voice still has, you know, a lot of power, if you wish, besides, you know, the mindfulness training per se, but it's definitely something that older, you know, getting a phone call is still something that people cherish.
Yeah, so the cohort seems to respond well. We did a study years back, and it was like a pre-surgical study. So to reduce stress leading into a complex shoulder or elbow surgery. And we, you know, the rapport developed between the teacher, facilitator, and the older adults was great on the phone. It's like a modality that made sense. So we were able to see some good uptake and good response and people looking forward to those calls. And so it sounds like it's a fine method for you, and you're going to be recruiting a lot of people. You're going to have a lot of phone calls here. I wanted
right.
to learn a little bit about that. I give so much credit to folks trying to run these large randomized controlled trials. They're so hard to do. There's so much management. So I give you all the credit. And how are you going to manage these? I think it's like 100 over 170 people, right? That you're going
right.
to be intervening with. So how is it looking forward in terms of getting all these teachers on the phone and coordinating all that?
Right. So the teachers is sort of the easy part, because we've done this now. Well, we had the Mind Your Heart one, and then back when I was a postdoc, you know, I did this. This is really when we developed the first phone delivered intervention. That was in, I believe, 1997 or something like that. Sorry, my phone is ringing. And so. We had the opportunity to really hone the intervention and test it and address, you know, the possible glitches. With the mindfulness instructors is actually always been excellent, because they do have full control over the scheduling. So we, you know, sort of introduce the patient to the instructor. And then they have an orientation meeting, because the sort of the framework is still based on the, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn stress reduction MBSR program. So it's 8 sessions. We just shortened the duration of the classes and streamlined anything that's not direct instruction for practice or practice itself. But the instructors do have full control, so they do their own scheduling. And the fact that it's you know, remote or phone delivered, is really good for them too, because they can deliver the intervention from anywhere. I remember one of the instructors was actually in a retreat in California in the first study, and she, you know, woke up at, you know, at night. It was still like night in California. She went into some far from the retreat center and gave her you know, session to the patient. Obviously, you know, she agreed to interrupt her retreat, you know, to do that, but you know, she had made a commitment. So, but anyway, that gives them a lot of control. So it wasn't difficult to find instructors. Also, we do enroll Spanish speaking patients in an effort to increase diversity, which is a big challenge. And we got a excellent, fantastic instructor, Alex Zima, who joined us from the Center for Mindfulness here at Brown. So he came on board and is going to teach in both languages, both in English and Spanish. And we'll see, because we're starting now. So, you know, maybe in a couple of years we can sort of touch base and see how it's going. You know, now it's all planned, but we're starting recruiting these very days Right.
Yeah, well, excellent. And good luck with that. And it seems like you've already had this experience. I think you'll do great. And we talked about these gaps to try to cover, you know, the delivery of healthcare and how do we support people to engage in meditation related behaviors and perhaps other medical related behaviors. And it seems like the telephone might be such an important way to do it and to further integrate it with healthcare services in that way. It seems realistic if we can have a well-trained person guide someone in a new learned behavior. And why in this circumstance might it be most relevant? Well, it's not like an exercise program, so we don't have to have technical motor-based activities, which would be really important to prevent an older adult from, say, getting hurt. This is something where, you know, guided instructions and so verbal behavior is the basis. And so it's really, it reduces a lot of those barriers if it is indeed effective at improving some of these outcomes. So I think we, in a way, you're solving one of the major problems. If it could get funding in a way, and given the direction that a lot of these healthcare oriented companies are going to get coverage remotely, it could work. It could work. There could be an interesting future here. Okay, so the modality is useful. It works for this cohort. It's got some promise if it can get coverage. And then what about the standard of care in this randomized controlled trial? You're comparing mindfulness-based stress reduction as an adapted program to be delivered by the phone. And I see that all the participants are also getting as a standard of care, like healthier living with heart failure. And do you want to talk about this program that everyone gets, like this educational program, and why it at least serves as a good baseline to compare to your intervention group?
Sure. So we felt that, number one, more than we felt, there are guidelines about, you know, what is standard of care for heart failure patients. So their guidelines agree in that these patients should get some education about their self-care. So the question is, as I mentioned before, is it always delivered as it should? So to avoid the bias, basically, because we needed to make sure that everybody at least got the usual care. So the optimal usual care. So optimal usual care includes those recommendations. And it doesn't have necessarily to be via physician. You know, there are online resources. And in fact, what we offer to all the patients, the study participants, is taken by from the American Heart Association website, right? So it is publicly available. And we offer it, you know, we mail it weekly to all the patients. You know, it's like 8 modules, if I remember correctly. And we ensure that all, you know, both the mindfulness and the usual care alone get exposed to this, because not to do it or to do it only for the control group, it almost was an issue of equipoise. You know, it has to be part of the care. So they might have gotten it already from their doctors, but in this way, we offer something to everybody. And again, we offer it to both conditions. So the mindfulness plus enhanced usual care versus enhanced usual care alone. And obviously, under the umbrella of usual care, now there is the current recommendations that the doctors may give to patients. Can be dietary recommendations. It can be, you know, it can be exercise. We don't ask people not to exercise or not to go to rehab. You know, that's entirely up to them. We do track them, and we hope that randomization will balance these sort of other components of usual care across both groups. But the only thing we exclude is as active mind-body practice. So anyone is actively engaged in any mind-body practice, so mindfulness or other meditation and or, you know, Tai Chi or yoga or any, then they are excluded from both groups. But other than that, you know, everyone can be enrolled if they meet other inclusion criteria, regardless of what they do for their usual care.
Great. So as enhanced usual care, everyone's going to learn about the behaviors that could improve their their clinical status,
right?
Maybe quality of life, and then adding in this phone-based mindfulness piece for one of the groups. And then, so for your outcomes, you talked about your outcomes, your functional outcomes related to cognition, attention for that original pilot. Are you still focused in that area? Have you brought in your outcomes? What are you looking to find here?
So this time we use the same. So the first main outcome is cognitive function at 3 months. So at the end of the intervention, this is the primary outcome of the study. We use the same modules that we use for the other study, but this time, instead of looking just separately at each cognitive domain, we do use a composite score, which is, by the way, a standard composite score that's proposed by, you know, the NIH toolbox, whereby scores, the software really calculates the sort of a global cognitive score, and is going to give us a nice continuous measure, you know, with a lot of power to see changes. And then, so that will be our primary outcome measure. And then as secondary outcomes, we will look also at each component separately. But I liked, you know, that there was this, this cognitive score was available as a possible measure. And I do have an excellent neuropsychologist, Dr. Ron Cohen, who is a co-investigator. This is his, you know, area of expertise, and that he recommended that we use this, you know, the NIH toolbox first, and then this specific measure to capture changes in sort of overall cognitive function, and then in the different aspects, which are the same as those that we, you know, evaluated in the pilot.
And then you also, it looks like you're going to be doing self-care scores, and that's so they're at home, they're engaged in behaviors that would be suggested for the condition of heart failure. So that's important, because that's the patient, the outpatient doing the behaviors that could potentially improve their quality of life. And then you're bringing in some of these HRV, heart rate variability, and other measures. And how does that add to the menu of outcomes?
Right. So the, say, aim one, you know, to talk, you know, sort of technical language, but they say the first, you know, goal of the study is to look at the effects of mindfulness on cognition. And then we measure 3 months later self-care, which is a measure that's been developed by another of our co-investigator, Dr. Rigo, who's an international expert of heart failure self-care. And it the idea is really to test the mechanism. So if we improve cognitive function, do we see changes in self-care? And on top of that, do we see changes in functional status, 6-minute walk, which we've done? And then we use a marker of heart failure, which is a measure also, is a measure of the heart function, and that's obtained you know, via it's a blood test, like blood draw. So that's aim one. Then aim two, which I love tremendously because it's really the most novel piece of the project, we look at interoception, which I mentioned when I was talking of, you know, my dad struggling with his heart failure, is how can we make these patients more aware of their symptoms so that they come to medical, they receive medical attention earlier. So to tell you how important this is that there are now, you know, medical devices whereby, you know, you can measure the pressure in the pulmonary artery. And then in real time, this pressure is, monitored remotely. And when an increase in the pulmonary artery pressure is noted, the doctor receives immediately an alert, and then it can increase, for example, a dose of diuretics. So what we're trying to do here is something similar, because increases in the PAP, you know, pulmonary artery pressure, are also associated oftentimes with worsening of symptoms. So people may notice a worsening of their shortness of breath, or, you know, sensing fluid accumulating in, you know, their legs, for example. So we said, well, why don't we measure interoception? So it's a huge here, you know, I don't want to open this because I'm also, you know, interested this in the in, within the cardiovascular realm. I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't want to get too far away with that. But what I like about this study is that we included self-reported measures of interoception, like the Maya, which is something that everybody uses in mindfulness studies. And then we did develop a protocol for an objective assessment of interoception, which is their heart beating task. So we ask people, you know, to we track their ability to sense their heartbeat in a standardized way. And I have a wonderful doctoral student from Italy, actually, that has helped us out to develop this this protocol. And the, here the model is, if we do see that mindfulness increases interoception, both the objectively measured one and the self-reported, I'm more interested in the objectively assessed one, because that really is the novel piece. Do we see improvements in self-care and in all the biomarkers and functional status? So that's aim two. Then I'm getting to your questions, which was, how about vagal control, right? And so, again, it's a huge area of research, and that's more to do with, you know, cognitive impairment and how, you know, improvements of cognitive function in patients with AD or ADRD, you know, the Alzheimer's dementias and related dementias. But we wanted to see if we can apply it also to patients with heart failure and cognitive impairment. So the idea is that it's, well, we know that meditation practices do reduce sympathetic drive, and they do improve instead parasympathetic drive, namely, you know, vagal control. So there is, you know, some literature on that. And we know that meditation does induce a relaxation response. So to measure heart rate variability, which is a measure of vagal control, nothing really super novel there. But what we're going to look is whether improvements in vagal control can affect cognition. Which is the, and, you know, I know there are other groups, including the group of my colleague, you know, Ron Cohen, they're looking at this using, you know, vagal stimulation in particular. It can be done also with devices. Here, the vagal stimulation is meditation, right? To sort of gain mostly through awareness of breath practice, right? So this could be also an interesting piece, you know, just to notice it can have all kind of, if we do confirm that we improve vagal control and then that is related to improvements in cognition, that could also be in itself something that's worth, you know, learning about and then could bring the research in all kind of directions. And it, intuitively also, we already know that because we know that when we are stressed, we forget things, right? We tend to leave the keys, to forget the keys in the car, you know, we do all kinds of things. And instead, when we calm down and we are focused and centered, you know, your ability to perform various tasks improves. So this is sort of, you know, anecdotally, we know that. We're just trying to show where that is true, you know, sort of if the evidence also tells the same story.
Great. Well, thank you for taking me through that menu. That's a complex menu of measures that your team's going to be working on. And you also have as a secondary outcome, hospital readmissions, which seems very important. And I'm most enthused and excited about these findings that you ultimately produce on that 6-minute walking test, because if in fact your teachers who are telephoning in and doing an intervention aren't really altering any exercise related behaviors, it's going to be a really interesting finding that you can improve like motor competence on an observable task through whatever they are learning and being behaviorally reinforced to meditate. So that'll be a really interesting one to tease apart. The effect there would make us think quite a bit, right, about the right extension of this sensory world that people explore through meditation to the motor and sensory connection of a really important behavior, like maintaining walking distance for at least 6 minutes. So good luck with the assessment of all those things. What a challenge. And we can, a final point here, just generally, and I think I can get the gist of this through your personal experience and through the study, but when you gain the outcomes from the study, as a scientist and as a human who's experienced this situation in their life with a family member, what are we working towards in understanding human behavior and quality of life?
So, well, this study can we have to see what it shows. And I've been trained by the research training and also my medical training to always be very skeptical and not over enthused, because we didn't have a control group, right? There may be a lot of non-specific factors of mind that have nothing to do with mindfulness training that are actually at play here. And I would like to be sort of super optimistic and say, well, if we do show, you know, any positive effects on any really of the three aims, it could be somehow, you know, I think it's a big jump for mindfulness toward really healthcare in real life. Not that it is not being, because I know that John Kabat-Zinn, you know, everything was born in medical care. That's how we designed, you know, the stress reduction program. It was based on a, you know, from clinics and real life. But this is some like a really prevalent chronic condition. So to show that this could really add something that would improve not only quality of life, we measure it, but we don't know that. Like, it could go, you know, all in all kind of directions. We always put in quality of life, right? Because it's sort of a nice sort of safety net, because if everything goes wrong, there's still quality of life. You can always hope something there, you know, is gonna, in this particular group, we look at heart failure, you know, related specific quality of life. I want to be a little more ambitious and just show that basically learning to practice mindfulness in a very palatable way, in the sense that we ask really, you know, the sessions are only half an hour and they're not 2 hours. There is no intensive retreat. We did show already some improvements using the shorter sessions, and also the literature shows that it's something that's really doable. You know, it seems like it can be embedded in people's life. I do feel strongly about the training part that actually may perhaps the app delivered, you know, practice doesn't deliver so much. I mean, I'm sure there's some that do, but for many, it's just plugging in something and then listening to the voice of the guided meditation or something, right? So the training, at least in my personal experience, is really important. Someone teaches you how to do it, you know, as only be sort of a passive recipient of instructions via an app. So, you know, but I may be proven wrong, but I do feel strongly about this. But in sum, I think it is, if we do see that this is, we know it's visible based on our pilot study. We do see some effects on the ability of people to self-care and or, you know, cognitive function. It's really something that can affect the life of so many people, you know, just learning to sort of incorporate that part, you know, of human experience in their everyday life. Because at the end of the day, it really is part of human experience. We just need to become a little more aware that we have that potential, right?
Well, and so you mentioned moving forward that the trial is currently, are you about to enroll? Are you close?
So we're ready these days. You know, I'm waiting like an official letter from the NIH to say you can go ahead. But we had the, you know, the important ones, IRB. We had the Data and Safety Monitoring Board approval. So we have all the yes, and we're ready to go. I mean, we're literally fine-tuning, you know, the visit sites, you know, where it's better, more convenient, or, you know, little really very, very specific details of standard operating procedures, you know, how to recruit this patient, where to find them, but it's pretty much done. So we're starting this very week. We just said, okay, let's start putting these flyers out and, awesome. And see how people respond and then see how it goes. I mean, we know the pilot went very well, but you never know. Every study is always new, as a new experience, and you never know. But I would say it's officially, as of October 1st, on nct.gov, we are officially recruiting.
Awesome. Well, good luck to you. Good luck to your team. And a fun personal question to end us here. Today, if you had a free full day, where would you spend it? What would you do? I'm always interested in what people do with their free time.
Free full day. Whoa, what a luxury. I think I'd go for a run, and then I think I love to read. I always did. So I'd like to go in a beautiful place, possibly by the ocean, and read without being interrupted. No phone, no nothing, and just lose myself into big novel.
And that's wonderful. Are you a runner?
Yes, but I mean, I'm a late runner because I
late bloomer runner,
but I love it. I started late, and so I'm trying not to be too ambitious because you don't want to, you know, destroy your knees by overdoing. But I love it tremendously. I mean, it's really a fantastic experience. So, yeah,
good for you. And you still have family in Italy? You go to Italy quite often?
I do have family in Italy. My mom is still alive at 91, and I have two brothers and a sister and a little army of nieces and nephews. And I try to go twice a year, especially now that, you know, we don't have pandemic restrictions, because I haven't seen them for a couple of years due to travel restrictions. But, you know, I already resumed my twice a year visits.
Awesome.
Can't wait
awesome.
To see them again.
Sounds fun. Well, let's conclude. Thank you, Dr. Blotch, for your time. Listeners can find our podcast at goamra.org. Bye now.